gave birth to baby in Mexico, didn't realize she was pregnant until 7 months, and her mother didn't think it was a crime. Argentine schoolgirl, 12, gives birth to twin sons. On same day, Mexican 9-year-old became a mother. Tribal law protects boy, 15, who impregnated 10-year-old Colombian girl from underage sex charges. Although records from the 1930s are suspect, the youngest mother in history is said to be 5-year-old Lina Medina, who gave birth in Peru in 1939. Counting only specific cases with provable facts reported in the news since 1900, 5 8-year-old girls are known to have given birth, 2 in Colombia and 1 each in Mexico, Peru, India, a Muslim, and Chechnya, another Muslim. As a result of the United States' meticulous record-keeping, the apparent rate of medical oddities in America is inflated in every category compared with official records from most other countries. Nonetheless, no 8-year-old girls have yet given birth in the United States, unless we're counting an apocryphal story of Bill Clinton's Surgeon General Jocelyn Elders, who, while pushing sex ed for kindergartners, claims to have heard about an 8-year-old in rural Arkansas who gave birth to twins, which no Arkansas doctors had heard of or believed. Since 1990, the media have reported on 53 specific girls aged 10 or younger who have given birth in Latin America. In the United States, with a population about 70% the size of the 9 countries where those births occurred, there were 4 reported births to girls that young, and 3 were to immigrants. 2 were fathered by Hispanic immigrants, 1 by a Haitian illegal immigrant, and 1 by an American. But for William Edward Ronca, there would not be a single confirmed case of a white man in the Western Hemisphere impregnating a girl 10 years old or younger. Go USA. In fact, William Ronca appears to be the only white man in the entire world who has impregnated a girl that young. In all of Western Europe, the United States, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand combined, there have been 8 reported births to girls aged 10 or younger. 7 of the 8 involved immigrants. They're changing us. In 1840, the famous chronicler of America, Alexis de Tocqueville, noted that although many criminal offenses in England had been abolished in the new country, Americans, quote, still make rape a capital offense, and no crime is visited with more inexorable severity by public opinion. He contrasted America with France, where rape was punished with far lesser penalties, and, quote, it is frequently difficult to get a verdict from a jury against the prisoner. Our Supreme Court improvidently abolished America's centuries-old tradition of permitting capital punishment for rape in 1977, over the objections of the court's 2 conservative justices, William Rehnquist and Chief Justice Warren Burger. But rape is still considered a pretty serious crime. While international organizations are constantly having to ask other nations to please take rape seriously, Americans have been taking rape seriously since the first settlers arrived, 4 centuries ago. But our post-1965 immigration policy is creating an America more like the rest of the world. We aren't helping the women of the Third World by bringing millions of them here. As de Tocqueville also said, nothing is more wonderful than the art of being free, but nothing is harder to learn how to use than freedom. This is where numbers make a difference. We're not changing the immigrants, they're changing us. The rape of little girls isn't even considered a crime in Latino culture, and that culture is becoming our culture. Gloria Trevi, the international pop star known as the Mexican Madonna, nonchalantly told a reporter for the New York Times that sex with a child is acceptable in Mexico. Quote, in the United States, a minor is a minor, and that's a crime. But in Mexico, she said, if the girl is over 12, quote, it's not a violation and you can't say anything. In fact, in 31 of 32 states in Mexico, the age of consent for sex is 12. Only in Mexico State is it 14. Credible accusations that Trevi had pimped out 12-year-old girls to her manager, Sergio Andrade, a man 3 times their age, only increased her popularity in Mexico. A book about police rape investigations reports that American policemen are learning to be understanding of cultural differences and keep an open mind about child rape because the Hispanic culture is more accepting of statutory rape. Describing his experiences working in one Hispanic community, an American detective said, "I have a large group of Hispanic men in their 30s and 40s who are having intercourse with young girls. I'm being told it's a cultural thing." Hospitals would alert him to babies born to 13-year-olds impregnated by much older men, and he'd show up at the girl's house expecting to find parents ready to string up the guy. Instead, he said, "The family will say it's a blessing and we're so happy. I'll explain it's illegal. They cut me right off. I get a lot of those, too." In 2005, Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, was less than 10% Hispanic. More than half of all statutory rape victims were Hispanic. The county gave up on prosecuting child rape cases because, as the chairman of the health committee, Norman Mitchell, said, "I don't want to waste the community's time on one item when we have a lot of items before us." Has the New York Times published anything about this? CNN? The Wall Street Journal? A 2010 government study of 2,000 adult Latino women in America found that 8% of respondents said they had been victims of childhood sexual abuse, compared with a national rate of about 0.1%, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Transplanting millions of people en masse from the Third World to the United States won't change their cultures any more than moving New Yorkers to Vermont made them flinty Republicans. Instead, Vermont became socialist. The idea that backward peasants will instantly acquire the characteristics of Americans is the kind of homeopathic magic New Guinea primitives would believe. "I know how we'll get Third World people to give up child rape, slavery, animal sacrifice, and human dismemberment. Bring them Christianity? Teach them to read? Give them economics textbooks? No, I've noticed that successful middle-class people live in nice houses in American suburbs, so we'll move illiterate peasants to American suburbs." This is what the Democrats and Marco Rubio are trying to do to our country. Bring in the depraved cultures of the Third World and pretend we're changing them rather than them changing us. Other countries are always welcome to adopt American ideas about equality before the law and Anglo-Saxon morality. They don't need to leave home to do that. Instead, America is just bringing in a lot of rapists. Chapter 12. Keep America Beautiful. Scratch that. Keep America Multicultural. No one seriously believes that bringing in hordes of Third World people has no effect on the environment. Preserving natural resources is an idiosyncrasy of prosperous cultures. Mexico is still in the slash-and-burn stage of capitalism, about 100 years away from caring about the environment. Our illegal alien population alone is the size of Peru. The Pew Research Center estimates that in 35 years, the United States population will be 438 million, of whom 100 million will be immigrants and their children. Numbers like that cannot help but to degrade America's national parks and wilderness areas. Will that wake up the bought-off environmentalists? They used to care about gridlock, overcrowding, loss of parkland, and exhaustion of natural resources. Not anymore. Today's environmentalists turn a blind eye as 25 million people tramp through delicate ecosystems, set fire to national parks, kill livestock, dump tons of soiled diapers and Pepsi bottles in the desert, and deface ancient Native American sites. Political correctness demands that no one notice immigrants' toll on the environment. Accusations of bigotry go up in smoke, along with our national parks. In 2011, after a series of devastating wildfires raged through Arizona, burning 500,000 acres of land, Senator John McCain said something uncharacteristically sensible. Quote, "There is substantial evidence that some of these fires have been caused by people who have crossed our border illegally. The answer to that part of the problem is to get a secure border." Instantly, McCain was attacked as a nativist xenophobe. "We have no idea who set the fires. It was probably a camper." Illegal alien activist Randy Peraz sneered of McCain. "It's easier to fan the flames of intolerance, especially in Arizona." And the pro-illegal alien Washington Post ran this bracingly original headline, "John McCain fans the fire of immigration intolerance in Arizona." La Raza's Daniel Ortega accused McCain of spreading fear and hate. Representative Raul Grijalva, also from Arizona, put out a press release the day after McCain's remarks, accusing him of provoking an extreme anti-immigrant and anti-Latino atmosphere in Arizona. 5 months later, the Government Accountability Office released its investigative report on Arizona wildfires. They're mostly caused by illegal aliens. When McCain first made his remarks about illegal aliens being behind most of the Arizona wildfires, Forest Service spokesman Tom Berglund stridently denied that illegals had caused one specific fire, neglecting to mention that illegals were the single largest cause of all of Arizona's wildfires. The Environmental Protection Agency issues regulations demanding that pesticides be purer than dirt in the ground. But then the government deliberately lies to us about illegal immigrants burning down our national parks. Of the 77 human-caused fires on federal or tribal land in Arizona between 2006 and 2010 investigated by the GAO, a cause could be determined in 60 cases. Fully half of those were caused by illegal aliens. Only 5 were caused by campers neglecting to fully extinguish a campfire, and the rest were freak accidents. One of the reasons the GAO was able to review only 77 fires was that the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service couldn't spare any agents for investigations. They were too busy protecting firefighters and their equipment from illegal aliens. Apparently, when illegals see Border Patrol agents, they try to distract them by throwing lighted matches in the brush to start fires. Not only do illegal immigrants intentionally set wildfires, but they violently attack firefighters trying to extinguish the blazes. Fires are allowed to rage because fire crews are forced to wait for law enforcement protection. Arizona's first major fire of 2009 occurred in Hog Canyon in the Pelencillo Mountains. With no law enforcement available to provide nighttime support, firefighters had to abandon their efforts at dusk. Overnight, the fire spread from 300 acres to 3,000 acres, eventually consuming 17,000 acres of parkland. Illegal aliens also prevent firefighters from using their radios. As the Forest Service blandly states, firefighters are instructed not to use radios when they encounter illegal border crossers, because illegal border crossers may believe that firefighters are reporting their location to law enforcement and react violently. I wonder if it would help if firefighters didn't have to worry about being attacked by illegal aliens. And wouldn't it be a big help if there were half as many wildfires? Calculating only the cost of fires on national parks, a fence on the border is a bargain. Americans begin a lifetime of service to foreign lawbreakers. The Forest Service had once gamely suggested trying to identify the group most likely to start fires, but once the evidence was in, they buried it. To blame illegal aliens would be playing the old blame the perpetrator game. Despite the evidence adduced by the GAO showing that illegal immigrants are both the single largest cause of wildfires and also the biggest impediment to extinguishing them, the government report dared not suggest building a fence. We can't do that because fences don't work. Diversity is a strength. Instead, our government decided that 100% of the cost of illegal aliens' fire setting should be paid by Americans. Let's teach Americans about fire prevention. After noticing that a lot of the wildland fires in California's Cleveland National Forest were being set by illegal aliens, for example, the Border Agency Fire Council in Southern California decided the solution was to hire Americans to go into the areas trafficked by illegals and put their fires out for them. Maybe we could cook their food and give them space heaters, too. Not incidentally, the Fire Council is made up of 43 U.S. and Mexican government agencies. Weirdly, it didn't occur to them to stop the illegal activity leading to the fires. Instead of being made a laughingstock, the Fire Council's approach was touted as an innovative approach by the GAO in its report to Congress. Drug cartels in our national parks. Starting enormous conflagrations in our national parks may be the least of illegal immigrants' attacks on this country's natural beauty. Because of new border restrictions after 9/11, I guess it was possible to tighten the borders, our dear friends in Mexico moved their drug cartel operations directly into America's parks. After the 9/11 terrorist attacks committed by immigrants, a lot of Americans decided to take their vacations here in the United States. If they went to one of our national parks, they might have been threatened with guns by other immigrants. One hunter in the Angeles National Forest was seized by illegal aliens and held at gunpoint for getting too close to their pot farm on American parkland. When law enforcement officers later approached the area, the cartel members shot an agent. "These guys shoot people," a Forest Service agent told the New York Times, "and they do not distinguish between police, hunters, or campers." The Mexicans also protect their pot gardens with bear traps, tripwires rigged to shotguns, and razor blade-equipped booby traps. In 2003, a National Park spokesman confirmed that, in this new onslaught on the parks, seizures of marijuana crops in some areas had shot up by 800%, far greater than anything we've ever seen before. At least we get absolute honesty from the government. 1 month after U.S. park rangers had arrested 8 illegal aliens from Mexico tending a marijuana farm in the middle of Sequoia National Park, President Bush hailed Mexican immigrants for their contributions to the American economy. With little media attention and complete disregard by President Bush, Mexican organized crime continued its seizure of America's national parks undeterred. In 2010, there were 3 shootings in the Sonoran Desert National Monument. 2 illegal alien drug smugglers were killed by other illegal alien drug smugglers, and an Arizona County deputy sheriff was shot. In the Tucson sector, which includes the Coronado National Forest and the Sonoran Desert National Monument, federal land officials spend 75% to 97% of their time responding to threats from illegal aliens. Armed illegal aliens were in control of our national parks, so government officials leapt to action by shutting down the parks. A majority of Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument was closed to U.S. citizens for more than a decade because it was too dangerous. Another bright idea of the government was to warn Americans not to enter federal lands where they might encounter armed illegal aliens. One sign read, "Danger, public warning, travel not recommended. Active drug and human smuggling area. Visitors may encounter armed criminals and smuggling vehicles traveling at high rates of speed. Stay away from trash, clothing, backpacks, and abandoned vehicles. If you see suspicious activity, do not confront. Move away and call 911. Bureau of Land Management encourages visitors to use public lands north of Interstate. Americans are not allowed in certain parts of their own national parks because of possible clashes with illegal immigrants. How long was I unconscious? New York Times. It's better to be brown than green. The environmental damage done to federal parkland by the Mexican pot growers is breathtaking. According to USA Today, the illegals scar the landscape by crudely terracing hillsides that erode under winter rain. They spill pesticides, fertilizer, and diesel fuel used to power generators that run extensive drip irrigation systems. They dam creeks for water sources, plant salsa gardens, disfigure trees, and leave behind tons of garbage, human waste, and litter. Park officers find deer carcasses hanging from trees, owls impaled on posts, and claws from grizzly bears displayed as trophies. Except for one fully brainwashed government official who said, "I don't want to single out one group," there was no mistaking who was dumping pesticides, chopping down trees, and threatening hikers in our parks. In 2005, James Parker, a senior narcotics agent with the Campaign Against Marijuana Planting, told USA Today, "In the last 2 or 3 years, almost 100% of the gardens we've eradicated are Mexican drug cartel gardens." Even the New York Times had to admit it was Mexican illegal aliens. 99% of the people we arrest or investigate are from Mexico, a SWAT team leader in Tulare County told the Times. Forest Service Special Agent Laura Mark said, 90 to 95% of the marijuana in California is now grown by Mexican nationals who work for the drug cartels. Following this explosion of honesty in the Times, the paper mostly dropped the subject. The Times will instruct readers to put a 2-liter soda bottle in their toilet tanks and to unplug DVRs for a greener home. But it hides information about illegal aliens destroying millions of acres of precious national parkland. That, of course, pales in comparison to the environmental damage wreaked by working toilets. Between 2001 and 2014, The Times ran only one other article mentioning the illegal immigrant marijuana farms in our national parks. Someone should tell The Times the Mexican pot growers are American loggers. Although the pot farms are entirely Mexican-operated, the Los Angeles Times reports that the cartels are working with Middle Eastern terrorist groups, including Hezbollah. That seems like a pretty big story to me. The New York Times never mentioned it. Times readers will be so busy rigging their toilet tanks to save water, they'll never know that our national parks are being decimated in order to fund foreign terrorists. Dumping pollutants by the world's tallest tree. In 2008, the National Park Service arrested five illegal aliens who had commandeered several acres of land in the Redwood National Park for a pot farm within 6 miles of the world's tallest tree. The Mexicans had dumped pesticides, fertilizer, and trash in the middle of this international landmark, doing untold damage to the forest. Three of the five illegal aliens arrested at the site had already been deported once. Like something out of Pravda, the New York Times not only neglected to report on the illegal aliens' desecration of a redwood forest, but 10 days after the pot farm was discovered, prattled about dreadlocked hippies in houses near Redwood National Park, where marijuana is covertly grown. In the Soviet era, the only way Russians knew there had been a plane crash was that the Soviet press would suddenly be bristling with stories about American air disasters. Today, the only way for Times readers to know that Mexican illegal aliens are dumping pollutants next to irreplaceable sequoia trees is by reading about hippies with indoor grow lights near a redwood forest. The Mexican assault on America's national parks goes well beyond what is absolutely necessary to cultivate marijuana crops. Reporters who have visited the sites gape in horror at the trash illegal aliens have left behind. Amid the plethora of two New York Times stories on the pot farms, one said that law enforcement officers have found elaborate tree houses, makeshift showers, and, invariably, trash and pesticides, much of which ends up in streams and creeks. The Fresno Bee reported that the illegal immigrants leave behind tons of trash, in addition to poaching deer and other park animals. The Los Angeles Times said of one camp, trash was strewn everywhere, empty cans, torn packets of noodles, a crusty leather rifle scabbard. A soggy sleeping bag was stuffed behind a tree. The chief law enforcement officer at Sequoia National Park swept his hand toward the piles of trash, saying, "Nice, eh? Welcome to your national park." Look at Mexico's national parks to see our future. For a glimpse into America's future, consider how Mexicans treat their own environment. In Mexico's most famous national park, a 10,000-year-old evergreen forest, designated by presidential decree as a biosphere reserve, illegal loggers chop down about 70 mature trees a day, or a small forest a week, according to the New York Times. While environmentalists from around the world send millions of dollars to Mexico to preserve the forest, local peasants indignantly announce that the land belongs to them and slaughter the trees. Marijuana growers set fire to old-growth pine trees in Sierra Tarahumara, destroying 200-year-old trees simply to clear areas for growing pot. Sometimes locals burn huge swaths of the forest out of pique with the government. Mexican authorities are helpless against these crusading peasants, who attack officers, set fire to police cars, and storm prisons to free illegal loggers. Sending their poorest, most backward people to the United States is obviously a big help to Mexico, but it's pretty rough on America's landscape. The sheer numbers of immigrants tromping into the United States can't help but to harm our wilderness areas. That's why the largest anti-immigration group is called Numbers USA, not Hispanics Litter and Scorch the Earth. But it's also a fact that the vast majority of the Teddy Kennedy immigrants come from peasant cultures that have no concept of litter. In 2005, the Sumidero Canyon in Chiapas, Mexico, was so jammed with garbage that it became a cause célèbre for environmentalists. In the first few days of cleanup, 30 tons of garbage were removed from the 8-mile canyon. Then 10 years later, the river was completely clogged again, full of plastic bottles, bags, styrofoam cups, and plates. As one Mexican environmentalist said, it's a war without end. Lucy Gallagher of Mexiconservación explained in an online video that people actually just dump the garbage on the beach. Pointing to beer bottles, syringes, shoes, and soap carpeting the beach around her, she said, "Pretty much anything that you can find in your house waste will be on this beach." After ritualistically noting that not every Mexican litters, the Houston Chronicle said that Mexico is, quote, choking on its refuse. Mexico City is flooded after every major rainfall because bottles and trash clog the storm drains. Soft drink bottles, snack wrappers, used diapers, and cigarette butts clog city streets, rural highways, and scenic beaches. Mountains of garbage stand sentry-like in empty lots and at the edges of bucolic rural villages. Discarded plastic bags hang in trees and dangle from cactus like bitter industrial fruit. Mexicans tuck pop bottles into hedges, trees, and lampposts. School children drop snack packages wherever they please. Drivers of inner-city buses instruct passengers to toss refuse out of the windows rather than leave it aboard. There are periodic outbreaks of dengue fever on account of the mosquitoes clustering around the trash dumped on the roads. The Chronicle was quick to point out that it wasn't Mexicans' fault that they littered. It was the fault of a deeply entrenched political system. My money had been on systemic racism. The logic is murky, but it has something to do with the system discouraging citizen input, forcing Mexicans to throw their trash on the ground. For decades, Mexican refuse ended up on San Diego's world-famous beaches by way of the Tijuana River. The pungent flow, with its brown froth and floating bits of plastic, carried excrement from Tijuana through 8 miles of rural California before landing on Southern California beaches. Border agents avoided the river, not only because of the smell, but because it, quote, melts the wax off your boots if you step in it, as one agent told the New York Times. This blight on California's beaches reached a crisis point in the 1990s. One solution would have been for Mexicans to stop throwing their garbage in the river. But as San Diego County Supervisor Brian Bilbray said, it wasn't like dealing with Canada. This is where the first world and the third world meet. Instead, U.S. taxpayers funded a sewage treatment plant on the border at a cost of $239 million. Mexico chipped in $17 million. The Mexican littering habit. The Mexican cultural trait of littering is well known to everyone, except American journalists. With the rigid circling of wagons by the elites as impenetrable as ever, the truth about the rampant littering problem of Mexican immigrants mostly slips out in the non-traditional media. The comment sections of hiking blogs are a hotbed of unfiltered reporting. After Labor Day weekend in 2011, one hiker's blog wailed. KCAL reports that in one canyon alone, they never mention which one, but it certainly looks like the East Fork of the San Gabriel River in the accompanying video, had upwards of 30,000 pounds of trash left in it after the long weekend. 30,000 pounds. The comments thread was more specific. Pissed off hiker says, maybe they should lower the price of water in L.A. County so the Mexicans could take a shower at home and wouldn't have to have bath day in the river. Jeanette P. says, I noticed the comment about the Mexicans. Sadly, this is more than likely true. My extended family is Mexican, so I know how most of them are, and the outskirts of Angeles is full of Hispanic people. I went last week just to sit next to the river that runs through the canyons, and I wanted to shoot the people who left their crap there. Red cups, abandoned sandals, plastic bags. Immediately I gathered what I could and brought it up to a huge green trash bin they had there. They actually had a huge trash bin. I don't understand the laziness of people. Earth is so beautiful, and I hate that people don't take the responsibility to keep it that way as much as possible. It's not just America's national parks that are being destroyed, but its neighborhoods. After suburban Wheaton, Maryland, flipped from majority white to majority Hispanic, the Washington Post reports the grassy medians often got treated as dumps, collecting beer bottles, dirty diapers, and fast food trash that longtime residents still spend their weekends picking up. Established residents, the Post reported, while absolutely not prejudiced and in fact delighted by their colorful neighbors, were, however, bothered by litter, cars parked on lawns, graffiti, and a rash of auto break-ins. Thus, local Ed Williford complimented the beautiful things Hispanics do to their houses and rushed to assure the Post that, "We don't mind the Hispanics. We're not prejudiced." His complaint was with the ones who leave the trash. They have no respect. His wife elaborated, saying, "Some leave loads and loads of beer bottles and trash. I think people get frustrated when they see that. That's not the way we like to live." It's not the way Washington lobbyists like to live either, but they don't live in Wheaton. Their maids do. In Tony Palm Springs, a letter to the editor of the Desert Sun complained about vandalism in a local park after Mexican Independence Day. The resident wrote, "Exercise equipment, landscape boulders, memorial plaques, utility buildings, and tennis court signs are all covered with green spray paint, proudly displaying the tag of some individual who must now feel very proud of this accomplishment." Similarly, in a Los Angeles Times neighborhood report on once majority black Vermont Square in South LA, the comment section consisted mostly of black residents complaining about the littering of their new Hispanic neighbors. Endorsing another commenter's remark that the neighborhood looked like Tijuana, Stoney said, "I work around many different ethnicities, and Mexicans just do not clean up after themselves. It's as if they've never thrown a piece of trash away in their lives. They just leave it all on the ground." One longtime black resident, Audrey, said, "Trash in the street is an ugly sight. Adults with children mimicking them seem to see no problem with their childish actions." A book about Mexican immigration, published by the Russell Sage Foundation, disputed the notion that blacks resent Mexican immigrants for taking their jobs, saying that actually what they resented was the litter, public hygiene, drinking outdoors, and noisiness. Do you see a pattern developing? Even a post on the Democratic Underground website reported, quote, "There is at least one new beer can or bottle a day thrown out on the area I try to keep clean. Fast food debris are a close second, and the final straw was having to pick up a loaded diaper last week." Other property owners have given up trying to keep ahead of the stuff. The roadside looks like some third world country. "I believe a large percentage of the litter is coming from newly arrived people from south of the border. If anyone has ever been to Mexico, outside of the tourist areas, you know why I suspect that they may be part of the problem. We have a large Central American population that are drawn here to work on farms and a large Tyson chicken plant that employs many immigrants. I have no problem with these people coming here to improve their lives. I do have a problem with people that reduce the quality of my life." In reply, one Democratic Underground commenter said, "When I lived in Mexico, we referred to the white plastic bag as the Mexican national flower, and that was probably being kind. Last year, when I spent some time in Ireland, I never saw any litter at all, anywhere." You know what else you didn't see in Ireland? Mexicans. Unless we're witnessing a mass psychosis, let's all get together and smear an innocent ethnic group. Hispanics are prodigious litterers. Even other Hispanics notice. In 2005, a Latino group in Boston put together a program to teach fellow Hispanics to stop littering, using street mimes to communicate beyond the language barrier. When a draft of their proposal leaked, there was shock, hurt, and of course outrage, and not just the usual outrage associated with anything having to do with mimes. Colombian immigrant Diego Luis Peña demanded an apology for the Hispanic-run anti-littering campaign, saying, "People are very hurt." Local resident Jose Ortiz said that the anti-littering campaign caused a lot of pain. Inasmuch as the rules of political correctness require that no one notice anything negative about Hispanic culture, maybe we should consider admitting only those immigrants we're allowed to criticize, like Germans. How can any immigrant assimilate if Americans refuse to mention their little cultural annoyances, such as littering, drunk driving, and child rape? The Irish would still be filling up the paddy wagons if America had treated them with such kid gloves. Remember the good old days when the Irish were our biggest problem? The Houston Chronicle explained that Mexicans throw trash on the ground because in Mexico, no one tells them not to. Unfortunately, no one tells them not to in the United States either, provided the person doing the littering is slightly darker than Joe Pesci. Ordinary people have noticed, But without these eyewitness accounts in blog posts and online comments, it would be impossible to make sense of news stories about park closures and mass littering. It's probably teabaggers vandalizing irreplaceable archaeological treasures. In 2013, Joshua Tree National Park was beset by inner-city graffiti on rocks and boulders, as well as on ancient petroglyphs etched by Serrano and Chemehuevi Indians thousands of years ago. The century-old Barker Dam had graffiti carved into it. Rather than suggest that any particular group was responsible for the vandalism and garbage, federal officials closed large sections of the park. Joshua Tree Park is located in two California counties, San Bernardino and Riverside, that had recently become majority Hispanic. 20 years ago, both of these counties were more than 80% white. By 2010, according to the U.S. Census, San Bernardino County was 51.1% Hispanic and 31.4% white, while Riverside County was 46.9% Hispanic and 38% white, and this from a Census Bureau that undercounts illegal aliens. Luckily, Huffington Post readers drew no connection between the recent influx of Latin American immigrants and the sudden appearance of gang graffiti in our national parks, allowing them to blame teabaggers, kids today, and this generation of parents. Commenter I.F. Tozy: think of short-sighted teabaggers running a town of 21,000 people for a dozen years. Thousands of people, only in the desert for cheap housing, badly wanting a mall and looking for something to do. Looks like some of them have found something to do. Commenter Silver Stacker: I'm surprised the kids today can get off Facebook long enough to do this. Commenter C. Jocko: yet another sign that this generation of parents is the worst in history. In 1980, Rancho Cucamonga was 88% white and 16% Hispanic. By 2010, the town was officially 42.7% white and 34.9% Hispanic. USA Today has a nice photo gallery of scenic Sapphire Falls, including one shot of four Hispanic men in the act of spray painting rock cliffs. But the U.S. Fire Service stressed that it was closing the canyon not because of the trash and spray-painted gang symbols, but as a simple fire precaution. Most of the canyon remains closed to this day. Overwhelming popular opinion on hiking blogs was that the closure of Sapphire Falls was due to the epic amounts of trash and graffiti in the canyon put there by Mexicans. One commenter on a hiker's blog wrote, "Yes, this is above Rancho Cucamonga, the Beverly Hills of the Inland Empire. But the problem is it's surrounded by places like Fontucky, Rialto, Ontario, and the like. Who do you think writes all that graffiti in the canyon? It's not the high-end soccer moms from Rancho. These guys find these pristine places and ruin them for the rest of us. Same thing happened to Rosarito, Mexico in the 1990s. Off topic, I know, but illustrates my point. I wouldn't bring my wife or teenage daughters here." Buying off the environmentalists. Where are the environmentalists? For 50 years, they've been carrying on about overpopulation, promoting family planning, birth control, abortion, and saying old people have a duty to die and get out of the way, in Colorado Governor Richard Lamb's words. In 1971, Oregon Governor and environmentalist Tom McCall told a CBS interviewer, "Come visit us again, but for heaven's sake, don't come here to live. How about another 30 million people coming here to live?" The Sierra Club began sounding the alarm over the country's expanding population in 1965, the very year Teddy Kennedy's Immigration Act passed, and in 1978 adopted a resolution expressly asking Congress to conduct a thorough examination of U.S. immigration laws. For a while, the club talked about almost nothing else. It is obvious, the club said 2 years later, that the numbers of immigrants the United States accepts affects our population size and growth rate, even more than the number of children per family. Over the next three decades, America took in tens of millions of legal immigrants and illegal immigrants alike. But suddenly, about 10 years ago, the Sierra Club realized to its embarrassment that importing multiple millions of polluting, fire-setting, littering immigrants is actually fantastic for the environment. The advantages of overpopulation dawned on the Sierra Club right after it received a $100 million donation from hedge fund billionaire David Gelbaum, with the express stipulation that, as he told the Los Angeles Times, if they ever came out anti-immigration, they would never get a dollar from me. It would be as if someone offered the Catholic Church $100 million to be pro-abortion. But the Sierra Club said, sure, did you bring the check? Obviously, there's no longer any reason to listen to them on anything. They want us to get all excited about some widening of a road that's going to disturb a sandfly, but the Sierra Club is totally copacetic with our national parks being turned into garbage dumps. Not only did the Sierra Club never again say another word against immigration, but in 2004 it went the extra mile, denouncing three actual environmentalists running for the club's board by claiming they were racist who opposed mass immigration. The three, quote, white supremacists were Dick Lamb, the three-time Democratic governor of Colorado, Frank Morris, former head of the Black Congressional Caucus Foundation, and Cornell professor David Pimentel, who created the first ecology course at the university in 1957 and had no particular interest in immigration. But they couldn't be bought off, so they were called racists. America's premier hate group, the Southern Poverty Law Center, jumped into the fray, with multimillionaire con man and SPLC head Morris Dees running for the Sierra Club board, simply to smear the three real environmentalist candidates as white supremacists. Yes, even the former head of the Black Congressional Caucus Foundation. Dees had never before shown the slightest interest in environmentalism. But evidently, what poor Southerners need most is a massive influx of foreign poor people competing for their jobs. And what the environment needs most is millions more poor immigrants trashing our national parks. Now the alliance makes sense, no? In 2012, Sierra Club Executive Director Michael Brune announced that the club officially supported mass immigration, amnesty, no borders, more legal immigration, the whole nine yards. The Sierra Club, he gushed, has thrived because of the ability for our members to engage with the full tools of democracy. Businessmen seeking cheap labor, take note. The Sierra Club's tools of democracy are new voters, who will give the left hegemonic control of our politics. At that point, the EPA will start shutting down power plants, coal mines, oil exploration, and so on. Environmentalists can't keep ignoring immigration forever. They have eyes. If mass immigration enthusiasts want to make the argument that preserving America's natural wilderness is not as important as transforming our culture to a poorer and more Latin one, then they should make that argument. Instead, we get bald-faced lies from the government, silence from the press, and bought-off environmentalists denouncing anyone who threatens their money supply. Chapter 13. Carlos Slim, the New York Times sugar daddy. Can we trust anything the New York Times says about immigration? In 2008, the world's richest man, Carlos Slim Helou, saved the Times from bankruptcy. When that guy saves your company, you dance to his tune. So it's worth mentioning that Slim's fortune depends on tens of millions of Mexicans living in the United States, preferably illegally. That is, unless the Times is some bizarre exception to the normal pattern of corruption, which you can read about at this very minute in the Times. If a tobacco company owned Fox News, would we believe their reports on the dangers of smoking? Guess what else Slim owns? A tobacco company. The Times impugns David and Charles Koch for funneling secret cash into a right-wing political zeppelin. The Koch's funding of Americans for Prosperity is hardly secret. What most people think of as secret cash is more like Carlos Slim's purchase of favorable editorial opinion in the newspaper of record. It would be fun to have a sugar daddy off with the New York Times. Whose sugar daddy is more loathsome? The Koch brothers? The Olin Foundation? Monsanto? Halliburton? Every time, Carlos Slim would win by a landslide. Normally, Slim is the kind of businessman the Times, along with every sentient human being, would find repugnant. Frequently listed as the richest man in the world, Slim acquired his fortune through a corrupt inside deal giving him a monopoly on telecommunications services in Mexico. But in order to make money from his monopoly, Slim needs lots of Mexicans living in the United States, sending money to their relatives back in Oaxaca. Otherwise, Mexicans couldn't pay him, and they wouldn't have much need for phone service either, other than to call in ransom demands. Back in 2004, before the Times became Slim's pimp, a Times article stated, "Clearly, the nation's southern border is under siege." But that was before Carlos Slim saved the Times from bankruptcy. 10 years later, with a border crisis even worse than in 2004, and Latin Americans pouring across the border, the Times indignantly demanded that Obama go big on immigration and give millions of immigrants permission to stay. What a difference one thieving Mexican billionaire makes. True, it's not unusual for the Times to root for the destruction of the United States. Maybe, in this particular instance, the Times agrees with every single thing Slim says. Perhaps there was a secret meeting with Slim. "You may have saved us, Carlos Slim, but this newspaper will be in no way cognizant of your financial interest in continued illegal immigration. You're just very lucky that we happen to agree with you. However, if you get into offshore drilling, we will take a very strong position against you." On the other hand, there's no question but that the Times has become exceptionally shrill on immigration since Slim saved the company from bankruptcy. Carlos Slim, fat, pudgy, white knight. In 2008, the Times was hemorrhaging money. Evidently, people were finding more economical means to line their bird cages. In less than a decade, the stock had collapsed from $45 a share to $15 a share. Ratings agencies were threatening to lower the Times' debt rating to junk bond status. By the fall of 2008, advertising sales were cratering, and the company had a $400 million line of financing coming due in May 2009, with no hope of borrowing any more money. Poor minorities don't get in as much trouble with zero-down mortgages as the newspaper of record had with its loans. The Times began offering buyouts to the news staff, and then, not getting enough of them, warned of firings. Company-wide spending cuts of $230 million were announced. The announcements were published in the Times, so few people noticed. As the clock ticked on the Times' $400 million credit line, insiders were predicting catastrophe for the old gray lady. For the first time, one Times employee said, "People are really thinking this place could go bankrupt." According to New York Magazine, fantasies about a white knight businessman who might save the Times with a cash infusion abound in the newsroom and in media circles across the city. The white knight fantasies ran more toward Michael Bloomberg or Google executives than a Mexican robber baron, but beggars can't be choosers. And that's how the New York Times got in bed with a monopolist looter whose wealth depends on millions of Mexicans moving to the United States. The newspaper's own Mexican correspondent questioned the deal, calling Slim the consummate monopolist and asking, "Does being embroiled in a business culture of back-scratching and unseen forces make him a great partner for the Times? I don't think so." The source of Slim's wealth is his telecommunications monopoly, handed to him by Mexican President Carlos Salinas in 1990. As New York Times financial reporter Eduardo Porter put it, "One year before Slim became the Times' benefactor, Slim got his enormous wealth by theft." He's a genius. He has a monopoly. In 2012, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, issued a scathing report on Slim, accusing him of impoverishing Mexico while feathering his own nest with a telephone monopoly. Slim's control of 70% of the mobile market in Mexico, far higher than in any other country in the OECD, allows him to pocket a profit of nearly twice the world average for major telecommunications companies. As Porter put it in the once-trusted pages of the Times business section, "Mr. Slim is richer even than the robber barons of the Gilded Age. It takes about nine of the captains of industry and finance of the 19th and early 20th centuries, Rockefeller, Cornelius Vanderbilt, John Jay Astor, Andrew Carnegie, Alexander Stewart, Frederick Weyerhaeuser, Jay Gould, and Marshall Field to replicate the footprint that Mr. Slim has left on Mexico." At least those magnates created something. Slim was handed a monopoly for a fully developed product, which he has done nothing to improve upon, unless threatening to imprison your competitors is considered a major innovation. When government officials pressured Slim to stop gouging Mexicans for their Telmex phone service in 2006, Slim demanded that the officials be thrown in jail. A spokesman for Slim's Telmex later admitted the threat, clarifying to the Columbia Journalism Review that imprisonment was not the goal. Well, yeah, obviously. The goal was to block government interference in his monopoly so he could keep fleecing Mexicans. Carlos Slim has shown more gusto for arresting Mexicans than our own Border Patrol has. When competitors were eventually allowed in, the Times Porter wrote in 2007, Telmex kept them at bay with some rather creative gambits, like getting a judge to issue an arrest warrant for the top lawyer of a competitor. One of Slim's business rivals, speaking anonymously, told The New Yorker about two guys showing up at his office and informing him that if we didn't take down our microwave link, Telmex was going to cut all our telecommunications. That was done by the man The New York Times is in hock to. Because of Slim's government-granted monopoly, Mexico is, according to the OECD, dead last among OECD countries in the number of fixed telephone lines per capita, 17 per 100 people. Second to last in the number of cell phones per person, and third from last in broadband penetration, with Mexico doing better than only Turkey and Chile. Mexico is far from the poorest Latin American nation, it's about mid-range, but it has the fewest cell phones per capita of any Central or South American country. 98% of Venezuelans have cell phones, only 78% of Mexicans do. The internet has changed the world, except in Mexico, where Slim's monopoly ensures that broadband is twice as expensive as in any other OECD country. When Mexican professor and journalist Denise Dresser returned to Mexico after several years abroad, she was shocked to discover that the exact same telephone internet setup she had in Los Angeles would cost three times as much. I started studying why the Mexican economy doesn't grow, Dresser said. So much led me back to Carlos Slim. Her body has never been found. Joke, I think. In the Economist ranking of crony countries, the magazine reported that Mexico was one of the worst, quote, mainly because of Carlos Slim. Slim steals from the people, and the people love him. To many Mexicans, The New Yorker said, Slim's wealth is a matter of pride. A 2009 poll found Mexicans ranking Slim the great leader Mexico needs. They might want to reconsider that. Slim isn't Mexican. He's of Lebanese descent. Usually someone in Slim's position is known as an imperialist oppressor. This is the man to whom The New York Times owes its lifeblood. Without a monopoly, Slim doesn't look like such a genius. He bought CompUSA in 2000. By 2008, the company had closed its doors. He bought a gold mine in Mexico just before the floor dropped out on gold. His purchase of a portion of the UK Independent in 2008 was, as he admitted, a mistake, a bad one. The single good investment Slim has made may well be his decision to bail the New York Times out of imminent collapse. True, the stock crashed from $15 to $6 as soon as Slim began acquiring shares. Even Times insiders thought Slim's investment was, quote, crazy. But what they don't understand is that Slim relies on immense continuing Mexican immigration to the United States, both legal and illegal, for his fortune. Buying pro-illegal immigration coverage in America's most influential newspaper was a wise business investment. How the richest man in the world makes money on illegal immigration. One of the ways Slim makes money off illegal immigration in the United States is by overcharging Mexicans to call home, especially during World Cup soccer season. Slim takes a percentage of all cell phone calls into Mexico, and Telmex's interconnection rates are astronomical. International roaming rates are 37% higher in Mexico than the average of all OECD countries. But the main way illegal immigrants benefit Slim is through their remittances. Monopolistic pricing is of little value in a poor country. a monopoly on air in Burundi would not produce the world's richest man. Luckily for Slim, Mexico is located right next to one of the wealthiest nations in the world. The OECD estimates that Slim's suffocating telecommunications monopoly cost Mexican consumers $26 billion a year, with more than half of that coming from Slim gouging his customers. They would have $20 billion less to spend without 40 million Mexicans living in the United States. According to the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, Mexican immigrants, or those of Mexican descent, send at least $20 billion out of America back to their relatives in Mexico each year. No wonder immigrants are so reliant on welfare. They're sending so much of it out of the country. $20 billion is significantly more, about a quarter more, than the amount of money the United States sends to Mexico in direct foreign aid. The $20 billion being sent to immigrants' grandmothers in Chiapas is forever eliminated from the American economy, unavailable for investment in American companies, the purchase of American products, or hiring American workers. That's a cost of immigration that Americans are never told about. These billions of dollars being drained out of the U.S. economy every year would be bad enough if the money were coming exclusively from cheap labor employers like Sheldon Adelson. But it's worse than that. It comes from American taxpayers. Not only do taxpayers have to support Americans who lose their jobs to low-wage immigrant laborers, taxpayers support the immigrants, too. 75% of immigrant families from Mexico are on government assistance. Then they turn around and give the money to Carlos Slim. 73% of legal Mexican immigrants send money back to their native land, and 83% of illegal immigrants do. Only because $20 billion is being sent by immigrants out of the United States back to Mexico can Slim continue to gouge customers for his crappy products. The majority of the money sent by immigrants to Mexico is used for consumption, i.e., to buy Carlos Slim's telephone service, shop at Carlos Slim's department stores, and eat in Carlos Slim's restaurants. Slim's businesses account for 40% of all publicly traded companies on Mexico's main stock market index. He owns more than 200 businesses, banks, retail outlets, restaurant chains, hotels, an airline, a mining company, Sears Mexico, a bottling company, a cigarette manufacturer, and construction, insurance, and real estate companies. What would all those businesses be worth in Burundi? That's why, in 2014, Slim was exhorting Mexican youth to cross illegally into the United States for jobs. The stated purpose of Obama's open defiance of American immigration laws was to avoid punishing children who were brought to the United States by their parents. Slim didn't care about that. Then again, neither did Obama. He just wanted more Mexicans working in America and sending dollars back to him. As the CEO of the Carlos Slim Foundation explained, "Our goal is to reduce the barriers for them to reach this potential, to build not just them, but their families, so they're able to contribute to the economy, i.e., the Mexican economy owned by Carlos Slim." Slim's income stream takes a circuitous route, going from American taxpayers to government assistance programs, to the immigrant, to his relatives back in Mexico, to services, food, and clothes sold by Carlos Slim. It would be simpler if Americans cut Slim a check for $20 billion every year, but taxpayers might object to being bilked to support a Mexican plutocrat. The New York Times protects Slim's income stream. One begins to understand why Slim wanted control of the newspaper of record. Since Slim saved the paper in 2008, the Times has been fervent in its support of illegal immigration. Oddly, for a newspaper based in America, the Times celebrates the vast amounts of money being sucked out of the U.S. economy. The Times thinks it's great that the poor themselves decide how much money to transfer from our economy to their home country's economies. But that's because such remittances are a crucial part of Slim's business plan. In 2014, when banks raised their fees for transfers of money out of the United States to avoid abetting money laundering, the Times rebuked the financial institutions, saying, "It is not credible for banks to suggest that it's too hard to tell suspicious transfers to, say, Sudan from legitimate remittances to, say, guess which country? Guess. That's right, Mexico. Rushing to protect Slim's money stream, the Times editorial demanded that other secure low-cost options be found, even suggesting that the World Bank get into the remittance business. The Times chose to publish this editorial on transfers of money to Mexico at a time when there was other news in the world: the U.S. primary elections, a Supreme Court decision on religious freedom and Obamacare, new Obamacare website glitches, illegal aliens pouring across the border, more shootings in Chicago, an Ebola virus outbreak in Africa, Russia violating a missile treaty, Israeli airstrikes on Palestinians, new Snowden revelations about the CIA spying on Germany, global warming still incinerating the planet, and the Republicans' infernal war on women. True, people have different ideas about what constitutes a major stop-the-presses story and what's desection stuff, but making it easier for foreigners to transfer money out of the U.S. economy was an odd choice for an editorial. Instead of another hard-hitting piece on the glass ceiling, the Times chose to devote valuable editorial space to fretting over a potential slowdown in Carlos Slim's collection of $20 billion from Mexicans living in the United States. It would be as if the Times had been rescued by Google and then began indignantly defending corporate tax havens. The New York Times is far more compromised by having Carlos Slim as its sugar daddy than any conservative is by the Koch brothers. The Times is not just beholden to Slim. He holds the very life of the paper in his pinky-ringed, perfumed, fat Mexican hand. Normally, it's easy to predict the New York Times' position on any issue because, A, it never changes, and B, it is referenced on a weekly basis in the pages of the Times. But that's not true of immigration. Since Slim waddled in, the Times has altered its stance from mild concern about illegal immigration to bubblehead.